She might not be a maiden who needs to be saved from a dragon. She might be the dragon.
To those who can hear me, I say, do not despair. The misery that is now upon us is but the passing of greed, the bitterness of men who fear the way of human progress. The hate of men will pass and dictators die, and the power they took from the people will return to the people.
Because history has shown us that courage can be contagious, and hope can take on a life of its own.
I will bring you hope, Holofernes. And I ask only one thing in return.
We move now, together.
Not at all. Hope is not lost today. It is found.
Hope is what keeps you going.
Even if the whole world is telling you to move, it is your duty to plant yourself like a tree, look them in the eye, and say no. You move.
Welcome back to Reading Rangers, a Skiffy and Fandy podcast.
Sandiganda, this is the book where Ivan murders a kitten.
It's so true! Ivan, you terrible man!
He shall henceforth be known as Ivan the Kitten Killer. Oh wait, no. Ivan, my kitten-killing cousin.
Ivan, you kitten killer!
Wait a minute, wasn't Ivan supposed to be here? Where's Ivan? Oh, he kind of had to wander off and kill a kitten.
Sorry guys, spoiler, the kitten doesn't live.
We're long beyond that spoiler event horizon.
Right.
But we should probably introduce ourselves at this point.
Okay. Well, with us today, I'm Kate.
I'm Alex.
And I'm Paul.
And yes, we're talking about Sandiganda, the infamous kitten murdering book.
The fifth in our reread of Lois McMaster Bujold's famous or Kosigan saga. Alec, tell us what this here book's about, besides the obvious.
Besides the horrible murder of an innocent kitten.
Feline fatality.
Sandiganda is actually the first of what I think of as the Miles Space Nancy Drew books.
I thought of that every page. I'm like, Now I see why Alex calls him Space Nancy Drew.
Yeah, I mean, he really gets rolling in memory, but we're not going to go there yet because that's my favorite book ever. But so in Sandiganda, Miles, for once, as Miles, not as his Admiral Naismith persona, gets sent to Sandiganda as a diplomatic envoy with Ivan.
Kitten killing Ivan!
Yes, Ivan the kitten killer. Because, I don't know, Gregor hates Miles or something, because the Empress of Sandiganda has died and everyone is sending like diplomatic missions to her funeral, and it might be a chance to get Sandiganda to be less dickish to the Barayaran, so that's why they're sent. And then as soon as Miles and Ivan arrive, they actually get directed to the wrong docking port, and a Sandigandan like shows up. And there's a struggle because they think he's going for a weapon, which he kind of is. Well, the Sandiganan is not quite a he. The Sandiganan is referred to with the pronoun it, which makes me uncomfortable, but that is the one in the book, so I will use it. So they struggle with it and end up in possession of this strange artifact with like a emblem on it that they don't recognize. And that's kind of the start of things. And then as the story continues on, you find out that the artifact they've come in possession of is called the Great Key of the Star Creche, which is basically the ruling society of the Sandiganan Empire, because the Sandiganan Empire is stratified into the Gem, which are the people who invaded Barayar a generation ago, and the Hote, who are like these weird, arty kind of alien people who spend all of their time genetically modifying themselves. And there's some kind of plot going on with the Hote where the former Empress, who is now dead, had a disagreement with the Emperor about how she wanted to proceed with the genetic goals of Hote. And she decided to go do it anyway in death, even though the Emperor didn't want her to. And that has set off this chain reaction of events where someone that Miles starts thinking of as Lord X is attempting to frame the Barayarans for stealing the Great Key, and then a bunch of other stuff, and people keep trying to kill Miles and Ivan, and it's just sad, and then Ivan kills a kitten by accident because he's a Fool with a Heart of Gold, and it ends with Miles riding around with a hoat lady in her float chair on the ship of Lord X, trying to foil the plot before the funeral ends and everybody goes home. So it's very, like, detective. That's the basic summary. I mean, like, if you haven't read it, it's a fun little mystery.
That's a pretty good summation of our general plot, and it covers all the basics, including Ivan's kitten killing.
Well, now, about this kitten killing, I mean, I have to admit, if I were Ivan and I came across a really pretty tree that seemed to grow kittens as flowers, I might be tempted to grab one too, just because kittens are soft and cute and cuddly. And if they look like they're about ready to, I mean, it was straight out of L. Frank Baum, you know, except in L. Frank Baum, you'd harvest the kitten would immediately scratch and spit in your face and pee in your lap.
You're not wrong.
This kitten just immediately dies because it wasn't fully developed yet, or is it because it's not meant to be plucked? That I wasn't sure of.
It's not meant to be plucked.
That's just evil.
Like, the whole thing with the kitten tree is that as part of the many social events surrounding the Empress's funeral, which is just immense and baroque, they go to an exhibition, or Miles and Ivan go to an exhibition where it's all of the Gem women are showing off their genetic engineering manipulation artistic talents. So it's like art that has been created using genetic engineering as the tool. And this is one of the pieces, is this tree that has kittens growing in it. And there's this, I mean, if nothing else, the book is interesting because it's this window into Sita Ganon society, which is a very weird thing, very stratified and has all these rules, and, you know, and we get to see through the eyes of the Bariarans, who are completely baffled by everything. And the idea is that, you know, the Gem women show off by working on animals, and Hoat women only work on people. But if the Gem women do really cool arty things with animals, then it can go get taken into the Celestial Garden, and that's, like, their highest reward, and it gives them a lot of, like, honor. So, kitten tree. That's how you get a kitten tree, and it's really fucked up.
By our standards, not by the standards of the Sita Gandans and the Hoat. It's perfect. I mean, poor Ivan thinks he's trying to save and rescue this kitten. That's the tragedy of it.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, he kills that part of the plant. I mean, that's the poignancy of it. I mean, he wasn't doing it because, oh, I just want to pet a kitten. He thought he was trying to save the thing, which is even more screwed up in a way.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, there's this whole question that kind of keeps getting brought up, you know, sort of as an aside throughout the book, is if the Hoat are even really human as such anymore, because they're trying to genetically engineer themselves into something else, which the Bariarans and, you know, Miles as the voice of that has no idea where they're going with it, because they just refer to it as the goal of Hoat, and that's all you get, and they're not going to tell you because you're, like, a little scummy not Hoat.
But it's pretty obvious what they're trying to turn themselves into, because they're halfway there already. How can you picture the Hoat women as anything but anime characters?
Oh my god.
Perfect white faces, huge eyes, hair that goes down to the floor but miraculously doesn't make their necks crane, volumes and volumes of white garments, and they don't even have to walk around.
It's true.
Anime characters.
They are?
If I thought about it really hard, I could even tell you which anime, but I can't remember which one I saw that made me think of it. Anime characters, that's what the Hoat ladies are turning into. And this was basically kind of a vaguely Asian, if Bariar is Russia, then this is maybe China, maybe Japan, maybe Korea.
I think it's like a little, Amalgam. Yeah, I was going to say a little from column A, a little from column
yeah.
B, with some really creepy eugenicist overtones.
Right. The idea that the servitors, the boss servitors, are basically also as genetically refined and engineered as the Hoat, and they're basically just like a shaved-headed version of the Hoat, was really kind of weird.
Yeah, well, it's like, oh, that's where we try out all of our ideas that seem good enough to try on people before we introduce them into our actual, like, perfect selves, which is just like, ugh.
And this was just a weird way of, like, creating a matriarchy that isn't exactly a matriarchy. Or at least didn't look like a matriarchy.
That was actually something I wanted to talk about.
I thought maybe.
And see what you guys thought, because, you know, there's this thing with Barry Aryan society, where Barry Aryan society is obviously a very patriarchal society, but this idea keeps coming up again and again, especially with Barry Aryan's, like, fear of mutation, that women are the guardians of the genome, and you can't do it, but I'm doing little, like, air quotes with my fingers.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
Which, I mean, in some ways gets into sort of, like, gender essentialist territory, but then we go into Seediganda. It's like Bujold is approaching the same idea from a slightly different angle, because, again, it is the women who are in charge of the genome. And that supposedly makes them exceptionally powerful. But when you look at it outwardly, you know, like outwardly looking into the society, it looks just as patriarchal as Barry are, because, you know, you got like the men doing the war stuff and, you know, being the leaders, and especially the Haute ladies are just floating around in little bubbles and never talk to anyone. And yeah, like, so when you get to know like Ryan Dagtyar a little better, you can see that she has this immense amount of power because she basically has the future of her entire species in her hands. But I don't know. I understand that, but also on some level, it made me kind of, if that makes sense.
Well, I was off on the wrong foot with it from the start, because they still use the very patriarchal term seraglio. You know, the empress was never out of the seraglio, and basically that's what it is. The fact that nobody fucks them ever, I mean, that doesn't mean anything, because nobody in that strata of society, I guess, ever does. Because, I don't know. But, yeah, the whole thing just seemed icky to me, even before I realized they also had this genderless category of person that was referred to with the it pronoun. No. So I wound up not liking this book nearly as much as I've liked the others. And I was disappointed in Miles for being so hung up on Ryan.
Yeah, he falls weirdly, oddly for Ryan in a way that idea I had not remembered. I thought, like, Miles, really? Are you? I could get Ivan being a horn dog instead of Ganda. Like, okay, that's Ivan, that's fine. But Miles's weird fixation on Ryan was kind of like, Miles, what are you doing, you idiot? I mean, granted, yeah, he's still getting over the whole, and they even mentioned the whole Elena thing, and oddly, this is in the actual production timeline. I mean, it's in the timeline earlier, but it's actually, this book was written after Mirror Dance and after a couple books, so I don't know why. I mean, I remember reading this the first time, and I saw it this time. It's like, I was kind of confused why Lois felt this book was needed, because, I mean, it says she went back quite a bit, going back from what happens in Mirror Dance, which we haven't got to yet. I know, listeners, we'll get to Mirror Dance, but it just seemed like almost like a retread. Like, is he trying to foreshadow Miles as in his future Space Nancy Drew role, as Alex calls it? Is it a way to try to look at Seediganda from the inside, because we generally see the outside of Seediganda? I'm not quite sure what this book really was going for.
Oh, so it sounds like I'm going to have a really different experience moving forward, because I will know all of this stuff about Seediganda as I read these other books for the first time that you guys didn't.
Well, I mean, I actually went, when I read all the books, since I came into the series basically after she'd written Captain Vorpatril's Alliance, so I was, you know, I was almost current before I read everything, because I hadn't even heard of them until a friend of mine told me to look at them. But so, like, I read them in internal chronology. So that was how I experienced it, was, you know, you get kind of like Seediganda as failed colonizers for the first few books, and then you actually go to Seediganda and are like, this is even weirder than I expected it to be. and then proceed on with like mirror dance and all that stuff. And you're like, oh, well, we're back to just mostly dealing with the Gem. So it's much more like comfortable. And about the only thing I can think is this book does set up some of the stuff that pays out really nicely in Diplomatic Immunity. But I think she wrote Diplomatic Immunity like long after she wrote this one.
Yeah, years after. I mean, I had started reading Wokosigan about when Mirror Dance came out. And then I started reading them in publication order rather than in internal chronology order. So when I hit Seed of Ganda, I mean, I had already had Mirror Dance and Barrier and everything else. So it felt I was off kilter right from the start. And weird side note, I mean, after a bunch of them had been up for a Hugo Award and won, and this one that wasn't even nominated. So I wonder if everybody just felt like this was like, eh, and just moved on. Because after this, I think Memory is the next one she wrote after this. I put you into actual writing rather than internal chronology. And so then we go back to more mainline rather than going back to the past, and she's on firmer footing, at least as far as I was feeling it.
So maybe it was a contractual obligation book?
I'm just looking at the publication list. Yes, Seed of Ganda was right before Memory. There was apparently like Dreamweaver's Dilemma, which is some novella that I don't even remember what that is. I don't think I've read that one. Well, and from what it sounds like, there's a note that says the earlier novels except Memory and the short stories, except Dreamweaver's Dilemma, have been repackaged in omnibus editions. So what I'm thinking is Dreamweaver's Dilemma, which none of us have ever heard of, got like published somewhere and has not been republished for some reason, so it probably wasn't that good.
I don't, as a rule, bother with novellas unless I really, really, really get desperate. If I've really just read the crap out of a whole series and there's nothing else, I might have a look.
Yeah, I just want to say I googled Dreamweaver's Dilemma. It's apparently a short story that is set long before any of the rest of the series, even before Falling Free, and set on Beta Colony. So it's really out of the main line of anything. I had never really encountered it anywhere, so there you go. So, back to you, Ak.
Oh, I was going to say, I never hit where I felt like Seed of Ganda, where I was going, why was this book written? What did it need to say? Like, I mean, I thought it was kind of useful as an exploration of the culture of Barrier's greatest antagonist, but I don't know. Like, every time it's definitely not one of my favorite books, because there's, like, aspects, like, the Space Nancy Drew stuff I love, but there's just a lot of stuff, and part of it might also be that we are looking at the Seed of Ganon culture from the perspective of the Barriarans, so there's already, like, you know, an extra layer in there, but I also, like I said, I was just sitting there going, so Barriar is, like, this patriarchal culture where women are in charge of babies, and Seed of Ganda is the same fucking thing. So, okay, they just do like weird genetic engineering eugenics babies. Okay, like, and that's the thing that bothered me the most, where I was like, it feels like we aren't even looking at that different of a culture, because it still has like the stratified thing. It still has a caste system. It still has a nobility system. It's got like, you like the weird division of the sexes thing. And it's just that Seed of Ganda has like a different layer of cultural bullshit and a lot more technology. And that's what mostly bothers me about this book, where I'm just like, it doesn't really feel like it's exploring territory that's that new as far as a clash of cultures. You know, that you'd think that. You know, God, send Miles somewhere that is like a democracy and make him deal with that.
That is what I want. That's why I've stuck with it. But so far, he's barely spent any time on Beta Colony. And that's the closest I think we've come so far. And I'm not sure, you know, I've only basically seen it gaslighting his mother, so I'm not that impressed with Beta Colony either. Mm-hmm. I'm hoping there's an egalitarian society somewhere in this universe.
I don't know if maybe she feels like if Miles got sent to somewhere where there's an egalitarian society that doesn't have, you know, similar cultural baggage to what we've got, that there wouldn't be any conflict, because if nothing else, you'd think, oh, it's still a place where, you know, Miles has to go and try to not diplomatically fuck everything up or whatever. So I don't know, like... And I also do like that it gives you background to make some stuff when you get to Diplomatic Immunity, which is another book that I really love. Diplomatic Immunity. So there's some stuff from this book that you get to pull into that one that makes you be like, oh yeah, like I know who these people are and I know what's going on and oh shit. But, you know, it's also, you could probably enjoy Diplomatic Immunity just fine without that extra layer.
And given the latter parts of what Ivan discovers in Captain Vorpatril's alliance about what the Cetagans were up to on Beriar during the occupation, this book kind of makes, kind of unlocks that key to make you, if you haven't read it before that point, and say like, okay, so given what we understand of Cetagans and the Haut and their weird eugenics, that makes sense what they're doing screwing around on Beriar and what Ivan finds. I'm trying not to spoil too much here for you, Kate.
Well, you can start by pronouncing Kitten Killer correctly. Who's this Captain what?
Who?
Oh, yes, Kitten Killer Ivan. So my apologies.
Captain Kitten Killer's Alliance. Isn't that just sad?
That is very sad.
Well, I'll try and lighten it up, because there was one character that I kind of liked in this that was new. And I was kind of interested in Lord Yunaro for some reason. I was more interested in him before I realized, you know, that he's actually kind of an asshat. But, I mean, I was really interested in what he was trying to achieve artistically, and the dilettante who wants to be a serious artist. I found that kind of amusing. He could have shut his mouth about the rest and I'd have liked him better, but... I mean, at least that was a new character that actually felt like a character instead of just, you know, a poster.
I mean, he's not the avatar that Miles basically worships in Rianne. He's actually a character. I mean, he's trying to humiliate Miles, and thanks to the manipulations of his sponsor trying to kill Miles. But yeah, he seriously wants to be an artist. It kind of almost reminds me of the Christmas classic where you have the elf that just wants to be a dentist rather than being an elf.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh my god.
So I get him. I can unlock him on that basis.
Well, and I mean, Yunaro is interesting because, you know, he's in the Gem, which... The one thing I felt like we really missed out on in this book is we find out about the Gem and the Haut, but is there like a class under the Gem? Like, who the fuck?
The Ba.
But the Ba operate out of the Celestial Garden, so they're almost like Diet Haut. So.
Just one calorie.
Just one calorie. Not evil enough.
So, yeah, you're wanting to know who the grunts are? Who the cannon fodder is?
Yeah. That's what I want to, like, I mean, because you get the impression if she's going for, like, this quasi-Asian influence drawn from all kinds of things, like, you know, so it sounds like the Gem are almost, are basically like the samurai, where, you know, their first function is their, you know, like, feudal lords and warriors and, in many cases, administrators, because someone had to do all the paperwork, bureaucrats, but, you know... The samurai still had all of the little serfs under them. So, like, do these people exist in Cetaganan society? That's, like, never even touched on, because obviously Miles is just, like, in this really rarefied stuff. But anyway, like, Yunaro is interesting because he's from this basically warrior caste, and there isn't a war for him to be involved in, and he can't be involved in it anyway because his grandfather super fucked up the invasion of Beriar.
And all he wants to do is make perfume.
Yeah, well, because that's, like, his one other avenue. Because it reminds me of, like, the shit about, you know, like, British nobility, where it's, like, if they didn't have money, that you still weren't allowed to go get a real job, because that was a thing that gentlemen didn't do. So you had to live in this sort of like genteel poverty and, you know, paint or something, because you weren't allowed to actually have a functional job, which is what it feels like Yunaro is in, kind of that situation.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And so he's like doing perfume because, well, you know, obviously he finds it interesting, but it's like his one avenue to try to accomplish something and maybe get some fame back for his family.
Uh-huh. Or become, you know, a serial killer. Or am I the only one that's read Patrick Susskind? I'm waiting for Yunaro to become a serial killer and Miles has to come back and solve all the murders.
I feel like Yunaro just lacks that level of personal initiative.
He is a bit of a layabout.
So he just wants to be a good perfumer, not a great one.
Yeah.
the tallest daisy is the one that gets cut off.
True.
And I kind of wonder, like, I feel like Ryan Dagtyar could have been a really interesting character, but I think in a way her being an interesting character is hampered by the fact that we're seeing her through Miles's eyes.
Good point.
You think maybe if we had a point of view from her, that might have been better?
Yeah, well, because you could see her acting as an agent on her own, and you finally get to see him, you know, starting to realize that there is, like, way more to her than just her being this object for him to lust after. When he gets brought into the meeting where all of the consorts are discussing things, and he has this creeping realization where he's like, she might not be a maiden who needs to be saved from a dragon. She might be the dragon.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I liked that line too, yeah.
Yeah. But then he's just like, well, maybe dragons need saving too. So, yeah, and then he just kind of, like, because he keeps trying to fit her into this Beriaren mold of, like, the lady he needs to save and protect, because I think he just has no idea how else to relate to women.
But where did he get this idea? Because, like, his mom?
Right?
Is certainly not that person. Elena was never that person. Where has he gotten this idea that that's what women are? That doesn't make sense to me.
Okay, so this is what I'm thinking, though, because there is also the thing to consider that your parents only get to have so much influence on you, and then your peer group takes over.
That's true. And his peer group is basically Gregor and Kitten Killer.
Yeah, and all the other little chauvinistic Beriaren males. And I'm sure that Cordelia attempted to squash that as much as possible, but also at the age that Miles is at, like, who the fuck actually listens to their mom at that age? And if you remember, like, sometimes when he's, you know, dealing with Elena or with Ellie Quinn or when he with, wait, we don't have Terry yet, do we?
Not yet.
So never mind. But like, there's so many times, like, especially with Elena, when she's getting to come into her own as a warrior, and you can just tell that Miles is trying to keep up with her in some way because he still feels like, oh, he should be protecting her somehow. And it makes him super uncomfortable. And he keeps entertaining this fantasy of oh, well, but then I'm going to take her home and make her Lady Vorkos again. And she's not going to do this anymore until she, like, firmly squishes that. So I think that Miles has this weird thing where he's super attracted to strong women that could murder him. But at the same time, all he wants them to do once he's, like, got a giant boner for them because they're strong women who could murder them is for them to stop being murder women and come home and be Lady Vorkos again and wear a dress and behave. And that is, like, how he deals with women, and it's super infuriating.
And then he would immediately lose his boner for them and go find someone else who excited them.
Probably. And it's something he'll eventually get over, but yeah.
I sure hope so.
Yeah, he eventually will get over this. It's just going to take a while. Sorry, Kate.
Yeah.
So one thing I was thinking about this book again as I was re-listening to it is that I guess this is Lois McMaster Bujold's attempt at looking at, I mean, we've danced around and talked about these eggs, at a society that's trying to go transhumanist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Does it succeed? Does the book succeed in doing that? I'm not sure.
I mean, I feel like it gets to a place where you can tell that that's their goal. And they're starting to get to a place where You're not sure if normal humans can actually relate or understand the Hoat, but I don't think it's quite there, you know?
Yeah, they seem to be on the verge. They've achieved ridiculous lifespan. They seem to have cured aging, at least to the point where, you know, all of these impossibly beautiful women that are surrounding Miles and making him pant are like 50 at their youngest.
Yeah.
But I get the idea that they're not quite there yet, and maybe they haven't really settled on what the goal actually is. And that might be why there's still all this jockeying going on.
And the whole plot of, antagonist plot of, let's split Xetaganda into 8 different factions and just let them repeat and grow and expand.
Let them all evolve.
Yeah. I mean, if you think about it, that's a super creepy way of having Xetaganda take over the entire galaxy if they had let it happen.
Yeah. Well, and it you know, it shows, if nothing else, that the Hoat only care about their own end goal, whatever the goal of Hoat is, and we're never sure of that, and they're just like, you know, if the little ants get squished along the way, whatever. Because, you know, Miles is spending the whole time shitting himself like, oh god, this would be so bad for Barry R. And you know, and all of the Hoat ladies are just kind of like, oh well, you know, it's what the Empress wanted.
And never mind, you know, like, do you think the Hoat even realize that peasants exist? I mean, do they maybe think their whole race only consists of about, like, 500 people?
Well, I mean, they obviously, I mean, they do know about the existence of the Gem, because the Gem are their randomization factor who go out and find interesting genes for them. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I the other question is, you know, maybe they understand, I'm sure they understand that servitors exist, but the question is if they consider them to be, you know, human life forms in that sense, which is...
Yeah, but if you spent your whole life just traveling around this tiny little garden in your floating bubble, you know, you don't even... you barely even interact with anyone except for, you know, the other people who also go around in bubble. Do you realize how many other human beings there are in the universe?
Yeah, or do you realize that there are other, you know... Because it sounds like they have that almost like... scientific remove, they're always in their own little bubble and they don't really have any kind of interest in other people except as a thing that we could get genetic material from if it's good enough.
Right, and that's why that people that aspire to be just like them create things like kitten trees.
Yeah. But it's art.
Whatever woman created the kitten tree, that's some high-level sociopathy right there.
Yeah, and it's like this weird cultural sociopathy. Yeah, I don't know. There's like some uncomfortable shit in this book.
There really, really is.
I mean, I think some of it is deliberate because we're supposed to be unsettled because we're looking through Miles' point of view, the barrier and point of view at this alien, strange culture. I think we're supposed to go range from what the heck to, oh my god, what is this sort of thing, but I'm not sure there's a coherent otherness to it. There's just like, there's these flashes of how things are so weird, but without a point of view character from Xetaganda, we're kind of like limited and locked down to the Barry Aron mindset on it, which I mean, I wonder if Lois were to write another book like this today, now that she's... We've seen books now where we're getting more points of view, that if she wrote a Xetagandan point of view, that might be interesting to see what they're really thinking inside their heads.
That would be, because, yeah, you're right. We do get non-Barry Aron POV characters.
Wouldn't it just be like Donald Trump's Twitter stream?
Oh, my.
Oh, ow, I was trying not to think of him or the 1%, but.
You know, I was going to say it would not be like Donald Trump's Twitter stream, because all of these people are incredibly well-spoken and extremely artistic and sociopathic.
Well, true.
They know but how to use punctuation, kind of... damn it, Kate.
And then don't have the hair.
Okay, point taken. But still.
Yeah.
They probably don't have character limits either.
They engineered those out generations ago.
Right. But my point is, we might be more sensitive to this flaw in the book now than people were when it was written, because we're living more closely with the consequences of that same kind of thinking, you know, where the only people that matter are, hey, I'm the treasury secretary, so I get to fly my supermodel wife first class to go look at the gold mine in Fort Knox, and the fucking taxpayers can pay for it because that's what they're for. We're living with that actual attitude right now. So I think I might have enjoyed this book more in the 90s.
Maybe. I mean, the thing is, I would argue that we've been living with that attitude all along. It's just now it's much more public.
Yeah, the subtext is now text.
Now it doesn't have to hide.
Yeah, and that is, like, I have a feeling you're right, where if we had an actual thing from the Seating Annan point of view, you'd spend a lot of time just being like, oh god, I don't like this person, because even if they're actually a really nice person for a Seating Annan, and they spend all of their time looking at other people as being sort of like subhuman subjects.
Right.
Blech.
Taking a look at Miles and being like, well, you know, I could maybe, you know, I've got the molecular tools to change that. And he's a little smart for a peasant. And so maybe we need to, and then he'd be acceptable. But as he is, ew.
Oh, well, I mean, okay. The my favorite scene in the entire novel is actually when the evil hoat lady abducts Ivan, and you find out that they're, you know, like Lord X, because I'm just, because I don't, Ilsam Keddie is after Ivan because they just cannot believe that Miles is the brains, because he's ugly and he's been doing all of his own errands instead of sending a lackey. So they're like, oh, it must be Ivan. Yeah.
That was actually very, very funny.
Ivan has to be the mastermind. Yeah, poor Miles is indignant when he finds out that they think that Ivan's is the brains, which is, I mean, we're still well within the Ivan is an idiot phase of Borkazigan Saga, so it'll be a long while before we start seeing poor Ivan get any of his due. So,
and in a way, I mean, it works out nicely, like, as a mystery, because it's in that moment where the bad guy kind of makes his fatal mistake, or a bad mistake, because, you know, he's looking at it through his own assumptions, so he underestimates Miles and gives Miles the in to do, you know, go do what he needs to do. So that I really liked as well, because it's like, yeah, you're from a culture of impossibly beautiful people, so therefore you underestimate anyone who isn't really, really, really ridiculously good looking.
Ivan has a high charisma.
He does.
Maybe not the highest intelligence, but it's not below 10 on the D&D scale, although Miles seems to think Ivan has an IQ of 6, but, you know, that's Miles.
I feel like Ivan's got a lower wisdom.
Well, I get the impression that Miles and Ivan both kind of trade on being underestimated.
Yes.
In very different ways, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, Ivan's entire bread and butter is attempting to be, like, part of the scenery so that no one will expect anything from him.
Sure.
Which is delightful, and I love how it comes in like, memory.
Well, I'll look forward to that.
It's my favorite book. Sorry I keep mentioning, but it's my favorite book from this entire series.
It is one of my top 2 or 3. I really like Mirror Dance. Memory is really, really good. So, yeah. Something to look forward to, listeners.
Yay!
But I think we have any final thoughts about See It Again?
Not my favorite.
Not the best.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like at the end of this series we should kind of, like, rank the books in the order of how we like them. But, I mean, I would have to place this one really low down on the list, to be honest. I think the only ones that it, like, is definitely, like, I like it better than Ethan of Athos, because that book has problems.
Oh, you had to bring up Ethan of Athos. Oh.
There's a reason we haven't read that one and aren't going to for a while.
Thank you. Thank you. What are we reading next?
Okay, so what we should read next, technically speaking, Ethan of Athos comes next chronologically, but I would prefer that we skip it because... Oof.
Yeah, if I have to read another dud, I might drop out.
So it's either going to be the Borders of Infinity omnibus or Brothers in Arms.
The omnibus is novellas, which might turn off Kate, but brothers in arms.
Well, no, I don't mind the novellas. I just never seek them out.
Yeah, I mean, the reason I would want to do like the omnibus with the three novellas in it is just because Borders of Infinity details the whole thing about what happens at Degula 4, which is like the catalyst for the start of Brothers in Arms. But I think you could also read Brothers in Arms without it because it gets explained. But then you also find out where Terra comes in.
Yeah.
I'm down for some novellas. I mean,
so, yes, listeners, it will either be the Borders of Infinity omnibus or Brothers in Arms, but it's sounding like we're leaning more towards Borders of Infinity, because those are good.
Okay.
Oh, Paul, do you have any final thoughts about Seating Ganda? Because I think we just dove right into what we were reading next.
Yeah.
We did. No, I think I've said everything I want to say. It's a flawed attempt at transhumanism that doesn't work because we don't never see their entire internal point of view, and that's a real weakness of the novel. It's not a bad book per se, but it's not a good Vorkosigan book.
Yeah, I mean, I've read many worse novels than this, but yeah, in the scale of Vorkosigan books, it's pretty sad. But not Ethan of Athos sad, and that's the most important part.
All right, well, thank you, listeners, for joining us here on Reading Rangers as we discussed Seed of Ganda. And thank you, Alex.
You're welcome, citizen.
And thank you, Kate.
Thank you, Paul. Catch you next time.
Bye!
Stay frosty. And scene.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you'd like to support us, you can find us at patreon.com/skiffyandfanty. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can do so at our email at skiffyandfanty@gmail.com, on Twitter at skiffyandfanty, and on Facebook at The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro and outro music comes from Dimension by Creo. You can find out more about them at freemusicarchive.org.